Okay, good morning. This is Shabbat, the 25th of February, right? And it is second day of Adar, second day of just after Rosh Chodesh, the new moon.
What is Adar?
Adar is the month that has Purim in it.
Oh, the Jewish month.
I did think about it. I tried to tie it in just a little teeny bit. But on this day, on Shabbat, Jews around the world do not only read the Torah portion, but they also read the portion that talks about Amalek. Amalek was the people that God commanded the children of Israel to annihilate. Mm-hmm. And they almost did, but they didn't fully.
Haman was Amalek.
Right. And then what happened? Saul did not eradicate the Amalekites. And that came to back to bite them, and just about eradicated the Jews. And that, but that didn't happen through miraculous events and Esther and such. So that is celebrated during this month, during the month of Adar, and the feast or festival called Purim. So there's one element to our study today that is going to tie into that. But it's a small point. We'll wait till that, till later on. But today we're going to be concentrating on scriptural connections and onward related to Caesarea. So Caesarea. Most of you have probably been there. Everyone's been there, right? At least once. On the sea. Caesarea Maritima. And I've been there often and guided many times. But I've had the opportunity to dig a little bit further into some details that I think will illuminate the connections we can have to the place, both in a Jewish context and in a Christian context, as well as just renew our understanding or renew our memories about the New Testament connections with the place of Caesarea. So I thought we'd begin by looking at the three P's. Three P's. Philip, Peter, and Paul. These three men have connections to Caesarea in different ways. We're talking about Caesarea this morning, and we're going to start off by reading different scriptures related to Philip, Peter, and Paul. All related to Caesarea. So we can first turn to Acts chapter 6.
What did two Philips? Which Philip?
Philip, Peter, and Paul. And, oh, was there two Philips?
Yeah.
Was right.
The disciple Philip? Or the...
Yes.
From F?
I believe. Is it? Wait, I'm confused now. Let's see.
Philip the Evangelist.
Philip the Evangelist that ends up dying in Turkey, right? Okay, so we have possibility of him being maybe part of the seven, right? Let's turn in Acts chapter 6, and we'll start there. These days there were disciples who were increasing. The Hellenists murmured against the Hebrews. This is Acts 6, verse 1. Because their widows were neglected in the daily distribution. And the 12 summoned the body of the disciples and said, "It is not right that we should give up preaching the word of God to serve tables. Therefore, brethren, pick out from among you 7 men of good repute, full of the Spirit and of wisdom, whom we may appoint to this duty. But we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word." And what they said pleased the whole multitude. And they chose Stephen, a man full of faith in the Holy Spirit, and Philip, and Prochorus, and Nicanor, and Timon, and Parmenas, and Nicholas, a proselyte from Antioch. These they set before the apostles, and they prayed and laid their hands upon them. Now, is this Philip the same as the evangelist, right? Yes, okay. So, we have reference to this Philip who ends up passing away in Hierapolis in Asia Minor, and his tomb has been recently found. I believe believe. I believe it's the same Philip. It could be the disciple. Is it a disciple or I thought it was...
There is a disciple named Philip. This Philip was first chosen to be a deacon, as you just read. And then later he went down to Samaria and became an evangelist. And at the end of chapter 8, he is traveling around in the Philistine area.
I think the Philip that was found, the tomb was found in Hierapolis. I think he was the disciple.
The disciple and not the evangelist.
Yeah,
okay.
He was his disciple.
So we've got a conflation here by me. So we'll have to check, but maybe you're right. Philip, the disciple, might be buried in Hierapolis.
They just found his tomb.
Philip, the evangelist, I don't know if we have a tradition.
This Philip is found later when Paul is on his way back to Jerusalem. He stops at the house of Philip.
We're getting there. Just a second. So this was just the first reference, and it doesn't relate to Caesarea, but a little background. When we turn to chapter 8, he settles in Caesarea, as you've alluded to just now. And we need this reference to make sense of Paul coming later and staying with him. In chapter 8, verse 40.
40? 40.
We have, first Philip is preaching to the eunuch, right?
And then this is one of the seven that you just talked about, the seven with Stephen. And
right.
So this is the same Philip we're talking about.
I believe so. That's what I've assumed. It would seem that there would need to be a marker if it was a different Philip. I mean, logically, somehow distinguished.
I think that, there would have been a distinction.
And if it's following two chapters later and there's not, I don't think he's mentioned a lot between... he's in 6, then he pops into 8 again. I'm going to assume right now that it is, and I believe it is.
Yeah, if you look at verse 4, it's right after Stephen was stoned, and it says Philip went down to a city in Samaria, and I was like 2 verses after talking about Stephen, so it's got to be the same guy.
Right. Acts chapter 8, verse 40 says, Philip was found in Azotus, which is Ashdod, and passing on, he preached the gospel to all the towns until he came to
Caesarea.
And this is what our focus is going to be on today. We find that Philip is still in Caesarea. We pick him up again in Acts chapter 21, verse 8. So if we can turn there, we'll see that.
Where are we turning to?
Acts chapter 21, verse 8, we see Philip there again. It's verse 7. When we had finished the voyage from Tyre, we arrived at Ptolemais, and we greeted the brethren and stayed with him for one day. And the morrow we departed and came to Caesarea, and we entered the house of Philip the evangelist, who was one of the seven. Here we have that. Stayed with him. And he had 4 unmarried daughters who prophesied. While we were staying for some days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. And he came, and coming to us, he took Paul's girdle and bound his own feet and hands and said, Thus says the Holy Spirit, so shall the Jews at Jerusalem bind the man who owns this girdle and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. So here we have 2 personalities related to Caesarea, but same context or same period. What we want to emphasize here is that Philip, the evangelist, is living. He's got a house anyway. He's got a house in Caesarea. And now... One recent archaeologist has suggested that the octagonal church, which is on top, and here maybe I should pass this out now. That's 7 with 2 figures. Why don't we just do this now? You can take one of these handouts and pass them around. We can see in this map that there is a temple. We know about this temple both from Josephus as well as excavations. That was a temple that was dedicated to Roma and Augustus.
It had a statue of Caesar in it, right? Caesar Augustus in it?
I imagine Josephus describes it. It hasn't been found that I'm aware of. That temple is found right in the center of your map of Herod's Caesarea Phase 2, or Phase 1, either one. You can see that right here in the center of the city near the inner harbor. So on top of that temple, there was a large 8-sided church. And now, Byzantine church. And we know that this is a common theme within Byzantine tradition. Some people link it up with the Beatitudes, some people with perfection, the number beyond 7. I still haven't pinpointed to that. If anybody has another explanation.
The Dome of the Rock is an 8-sided building.
Right. No, we have many examples. Beatitudes, Dome of the Rock, and Bethlehem, different aspects of 8-sided buildings that are from the Byzantine period or Byzantine impetuses that were used later on by Muslim architects. But we have an 8-sided building anyway here on top of that temple. That's the point. And this recent archaeologist, Rena Avner, has suggested that maybe this might be the Church of Philip. That's just a suggestion, and it doesn't necessarily hold weight, but we do have a house, maybe the house church, maybe dedicated to him. We don't have a name for that, and so it's just a nice possibility, nothing more than that. We definitely have a large Byzantine church on top of the temple, which is then later on built upon by the Muslims for a mosque, right? And then the Crusaders, and then destroyed in 1265 by Baibars, the Sultan, who eradicated all ports because he wasn't very skilled at sailing, or he didn't have a navy. So that was the end of Caesarea, basically, until the recent time period. And there were some Bosnians that were put in there by the Ottomans in the late 1800s because they were refugees and having problems of their own, so they stuck them in Caesarea at the end of the 1800s, and they stayed there until 1948, and then it was no longer inhabited. So, very brief history there. The emphasis I wanted to make here is between Philip, the possibility that there could be a church named after him because he has a house there.
And then, there's a Jewish section to the city, isn't there?
Yeah, we're going to get to that. There's a possibility. We definitely have Jewish presence, and I should move quickly. Okay. So we saw now that Paul is staying with Philip on his last journey up to Jerusalem before he has these diaspora and Asia Minor Jews who get it wrong and get him arrested. And then what happens from Jerusalem? Well, now I'm jumping ahead to Paul, but he goes up to Jerusalem. The Asia Minor Jews cause a ruckus, get it wrong, get him in prison. Then they hear that there's a threat on his life. He's brought back down to Antipatris, which is effect, right? And then to Caesarea, where he's there for 2.5 years before he goes to Nero in Rome. But before we get to Paul officially, let's talk about Peter briefly. We're just going over, for those who have just arrived, we're going over New Testament connections with Caesarea. We're going to be spending some time on archaeology and possible connections with New Testament themes as well as Jewish themes and some Byzantine Christian themes. Not only the church, but another chapel that's been recently excavated. So, now we're moving to Peter, and we can turn to Acts chapter 10. Most of us will remember that this passage is famous for the sheet coming down 3 times, right? And we have this stage of Cornelius stationed in Caesarea. It makes a lot of sense because after 6 AD CE, we have Rome officially reigning from there directly or via Syria, but without a Jewish king, except for later on with Agrippa, but still we have a direct connection with Rome. So we have a strong Roman presence occupying and staying or settling, living in Caesarea. So it's not surprising that we have Cornelius here, a centurion, stationed in Caesarea, and this dialogue that goes on between him and Peter about relating to non-Jews. Right, we've gone over this many times. The issue is not about menu, it's about men. And we won't be able to go into that now, but we have many biblical and non-biblical examples of animals being related to people, right?
You mean that God didn't throw out the book of Leviticus by giving somebody a vision in the middle of the afternoon?
Right. So that's what I'm saying. God did not throw out the book of Leviticus
by sending
a vision to Peter, who had never eaten anything unclean, and finally gets a knock on the door, and he associates now with Cornelius, and this is the big thing. It seems that these early Christian Jews were very religious, not just regular mitzvot, but not regular commandments, but even traditions, and they were living out these traditions on top of the commandments to an extent that excluded many people and brought division that was uncalled for. That some of that is God-given and some of it is not. That needs to be unpacked very sensitively. But at least in this case, in this particular case, we have Peter being commanded that it's okay to fellowship with Cornelius. Not to eat non-kosher food, but to fellowship with him. And maybe he brings his food, or they have kosher food together, but he's going into his house, and this seems to be an issue. Okay, so we have 10:1 and 10:24, chapter 10:1 and chapter 10:24, where we have Caesarea coming into place. And the next day, we'll read verse 23 and following. The next day he rose and went off with him, and some of the brethren from Joppa accompanied him, and on the following day they entered Caesarea. Cornelius was expecting them and had called together his kinsmen and close friends. When Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet, worshipped him. What I want to emphasize here is just that Cornelius is a centurion, and he is stationed in Caesarea. And this relates to a praetorium that seems to have been found, and not just a praetorium, but different rooms, a scuola and a prison area or a prisoner area that make up a complex of Roman military institutions from the 1st to the 3rd century. And maybe this is a good time to pass out the next thing. I only made 7 of these. I should have made more. Okay, so maybe, Gary, can I ask you? I'm making like 5 more. Okay. It's open. So on this handout that we see here, on the left-hand side, we can see 2 phases of the promontory place. It's open. Thanks, sir. And this is by Gleason and Netzer and other archaeologists, as well as later on Yosef Porat. And you can see a division at the top between the IAA and the University of Pennsylvania. And that division is kind of important for seeing different things below. As is the case in national parks, there is a desire to make the parks accessible and attractive to clients. And so in 1994, they had an adrenaline push to run through excavations, and they reissued the permit in 93 to 94 from University of Pennsylvania to the Israel Antiquities Authority, and they kind of dug at a very, very quick pace. Not that they dug poorly, but that's why we have somewhat differing interpretations. When you visit, this is one of the biggest things I want to share with you. It's so small, but for me it was very important. And finally, like at 1 in the morning last night, I figured it out. Looking at pictures and things, because it's not very clear. But when you visit Caesarea today and you go into this audience room, which is on your diagram on the right, it's not marked. It's this, let me just hold this up for a second. This area right here, can you see next to the hippodrome or stadium?
Yeah.
That is the place that has the signs and where it says, you know, Paul shared in Acts 23 and such, right? So this is taken to be the audience room. And they have found some new mosaics right? But what has been published officially and more fully is this aspect of the lower and the upper, and this area of E and F on your upper diagram is thought to be the audience room and the bima. I don't have the last word on this, but just to clarify that we have strong evidence for Roman presence of a praetorium in this area because of ceramics, because of a bath house area, because of the description of Josephus that says it's south and what is it? It's very close to the stadium, the hippodrome. And so, from Josephus' description, so we have a lot of things connecting the dots to be an area of the praetorium.
Praetorium is
a barracks, or not just a barracks, but a military installation that where the governor and military personnel reside and have their offices.
So when you say stadium, you're not referring to some stadium that's existing now that where they play games. You're referring to a Roman stadium that was
correct.
There at that time.
It's still to be seen today. You can still visit it and see it today. That's that curved U there. Well, you can't see much of the U, but the dark black, it says stadium, right? And it's known as circus or hippodrome. It's also known as amphitheater. Why does it have all these names? Because it, over time, it changed functions. So we have this hippodrome that's smashed in about the 2nd century to be an amphitheater. So right there we've got a multi... And an amphitheater is more for physical games and beasts and things like that, right?
Because the city shrunk and they didn't need something so large anymore?
It might have been. What they do is they build another amphitheater later, though. In the 3rd century, we have a new amphitheater, a proper amphitheater built that's never been excavated, but they can see it from the air. You can see
where
it.
Where is it? It's inland.
Yeah, it's inland, and I have a picture of it here on that computer, and I'm not quite set up. I was going to run through pictures, but it's not quite ready, so I can show you. It's not... Oh, on this map, that's right. Is this kind of
outside the walls?
On this map, it is... Okay, this is Herod's history, so it would be up by the wall.
North, south?
Yeah, north, up where it says wall. Somewhere right in here. Right here. Because the Roman city is large, but the Byzantine city is massive. All the cities, just about all the cities, not all, many of the cities in Palestine, as it was then known, what do you call it? Enlarged and had their height of size in the Byzantine period. This seems to be a very rich time, and especially along the coast, because the Byzantines are involved a lot in trade, and whereas Nabataeans or Arabs are a little more involved in the Levant area, and so the coastal Caesarea is a prime example.
Refresh my memory, when we say Byzantine period, we're talking about...
325 until 630. 300 years.
325 to 630.
After the Roman, let's say. Period. I mean, 613 is the Persians, and then 638. 613, more exactly.
Maybe to clarify, in Europe, they use different... Byzantine
right.
means something totally different in Europe.
Right.
Those
it's
dates
a Byzantine
are
presence here.
Byzantine period here, post, well, it's pre-Islamic when the Islamic invasion came, and it starts from Constantine, and that's called Byzantine period here. Whereas up in Europe, sometimes the Byzantine period runs all the way up to 1453 when Constantinople got overturned. And that's a different Byzantine altogether. Well, it's just the word Byzantine period in English depends on where you are.
Right. So, the main point I want to make here, I want to hold off actually. Well, I've already started. We're still at Peter. We're done with Peter. Now we're on to Paul. Okay, so now I want to make it here. Paul is on defense in Acts 23, right? And he is very, very likely, and we've got now multiple people saying this, so it's not just one person. So you know, you want to be skeptical about people making too strong a statement that Paul was here. But we've got Catherine Gleason, University of Pennsylvania. We've got Patrick, who is at the University of Haifa. Now he's at Hebrew University. And we have a lot of voices now arguing that this is the Roman Praetorium from the 1st to the 3rd century. It moves from the 4th to the 6th century up in area KK up above. But here in this period. And so it's a very strong possibility. So that's kind of
possibility
fun.
Of what?
Of Paul being in where it says E.
Is where he was held captive for the 2.5 years.
Well, now this is another question. Where is Paul's prison? And we have some nice articles by Patrick about this. There's another section which we're going to get to in a few minutes that is Byzantine in nature, and we have even a Paulus inscription, and we have dozens of Christian artifacts related to a chapel, it seems, and so some suggestions that he was there. More likely, this is maybe a later venerated area, yes, but more likely he is somewhere in this area of the promontory place. I didn't make this clear to some who haven't been to Caesarea, maybe, that here we have the harbor, here's the Hippodrome Amphitheater, and here is the promontory palace, right? So this here on the left is an enlargement of that little section here on the bottom left of the larger map of Caesarea, right? This is the enlargement on the left. And right is the map of all of Caesarea from Herod's time period. And so that little palace down here is enlarged here to the left, okay? And so likely somewhere close in this area, Paul is held. Mm-hmm. Where that prison is, we don't know. And Patrick.
What does prison mean with a palace?
Yeah, well, it's not just a palace. It's a
garrison.
Yeah, it's a garrison. It's a praetorium area. Administrative government officials. And we have now, after Gleason, we have now, and it's not on the map so much, but you have to look at this map here. At the bottom of the amphitheater, we have a four-pillared entrance to this palace area. And near here, between this empty area and the enlargement, and here, there's been a couple of 3rd century inscriptions that talk about the Praetorium, which is a known Latin term for a group of palace guards, and another institution, the Scula, I think it's called as well. So we have a number of... Back to the Praetorium.
That's also we have Silvanus' inscription. Silvanus and Junia, right outside in front of the palace.
Is that right by the palace? Is that?
Well, it's.
Isn't that the Byzantine palace?
Well, it's on the south end of the Hippodrome.
Is it? It's
near. It's outside the palace, but it's near.
What does it say?
It just says, I forget exactly, but it says, you know, blessings, may Silvanus and Julia live happily ever after or something.
But it doesn't necessarily relate to a Roman institution. But we have names, okay.
Other than it's probably a Byzantine inscription.
Right. This is a depiction I would have set up, but I'm not quite right. But we're small enough, we can kind of see a little bit. And you can see it later if you want. This is the excavated area that is E here. And if we look at aerials of the place today, it's completely covered up. So you're only, when you come to the site today, you're only focusing on the IAA site, on the right-hand side. Does that make sense?
Why they cover it up?
I think it's because...
It's political?
I don't know. It seems very strange.
Oh, Dave, you guys, I've been reading, all you're seeing is the open area.
That's right.
All the other has been covered back over.
Yeah.
They just took dirt and covered it
up. Yeah, and this is it. I mean, a bit, and you can see... Okay, this is not... That's what we're going to do later.
I mean, they do that when they don't have money to maintain it.
Do it right.
Yeah, maybe that's also true. It might be that.
Or to
but it's more than that because I read the
or something
that
right.
I read the
Geographic.
The fifth volume of the Holy Land Encyclopedia. Right? And it's written by Porat, and it's all IAA excavated. And before I knew about this, I was like, man, he's really emphasizing that IAA excavated this area.
Right.
And then I read this, and I was like, oh, now I see. So something's a little bit funny there. This is a reconstruction of the audience hall. Now, what's interesting for Gleason, she argues there is a raised platform here. It's a funny kind of raised platform because it's made of hypocaust. Clay circles stacked on top of each other to make a little pillar. But there's no other water...
A pillar or a raised floor?
A raised floor.
Like a bathhouse.
Exactly. But there's no water installations around it. So it's not clear. We have a raised false floor that's typically used for a bathhouse, but then they found no water installations. So is this a cheaper way or some way of making a bima? One doesn't know, but a bima is a raised platform that a tribunal or that Paul might have been brought to.
Because we have like a judge's seat or where you put the judge up high.
Because we've got three different terms being used for three different occurrences as well. We've got Paul before Felix, and then we've got Paul before Festus, and we also have this interlude, right, with Agrippa and his wife. And so we have three different areas that is talked about over these chapters in Acts, and all in Caesarea. So she argues that this is the audience room. We have some very nice mosaic floors. Nothing that argues definitively that this is the audience hall, but I'm still waiting on one article that I couldn't get by Hannah Cotton and Eck. 2001 that might bring out more details from an inscription that was published that I haven't been able to get my hands on yet. Okay, so that's the praetorium and the first century through the third century praetorium. By the fourth through the fifth century, the government offices move to what we see here as this decumanos. 50, does it say 50? That's hard to read. S2, that's right, sorry. S1, S2. So if you go from the temple and you go down an insula, which is a block, it's also kind of new for me. An insula is not just a type of building, but it's also the building that's found in a block. You come down that insula, then you're coming to the top, the starting gates of the hippodrome. Yes? Mm-hmm. And you come across... the Cardo Maximus, yes, which is kind of like the central Cardo here. Mm-hmm. And just in that grid, below Decumenos S2 and the Cardo Maximus, we have a large Byzantine governmental administration, law court, tax area. And we've got hundreds of details related to that.
Two verses from the New Testament.
That's right. We've got Romans 13:3, give to the government if you're a good person. They put it inside, because they're Byzantines now, right? So they give me the money. And we've got lead weights.
Render to Caesar what is Caesar's?
Right.
That one?
Yeah.
If you,
two of them.
Yeah. How does it go? If you don't want to fear the government, then do what is right.
Right. But there's two. I think it's also render to Caesar.
It's the same verse.
Yeah. Right. So.
Nice. Uh-huh. That means they misspelled the Greek in ways that they were pronouncing.
So we have a very clear Byzantine administrative area here. And more recently, in this area that I've just pointed out, they have discovered a chapel, a sort of reworked warehouse that comes into a large chapel with dozens of graffiti types of things. Here is the chapel and the courtyard. This is facing north. So here is the Decumanus and here is the Cardo Maximus. Here's a larger grid. Now you can see the Decumanus and the Cardo. Can anybody see this or not really? A little bit?
Yeah.
And you can see where it is? Yes? And here are some of the things that they found. Marble screen plate, a eulogia flask, a bread stamp from 4th century, a set of crosses. There's the drawing, some plaster work. A set of stairs that goes down from below and above. It seems that maybe people were buried down below. Some saints. Saint Paulus. That's not what I want to see. Yeah, okay, and here is, this is Paulo. It's missing the U or the O, S, sigma. But you get the name of Paul. And so some people have argued that it's Saint Paul. But we have two other Pauls that die or are known figures in Caesarea, because Caesarea has a rich Christian heritage, and so it's not certain at all that it's related to St. Paul, but could be another Paul. But in any case, we have a high concentration of Christian veneration here in that area, and some people argue that it's a chapel of St. Paul. Patrick says no, it's a highly venerated Christian place. We have two suggested fragments of sarcophagi. So we've probably got two patron or two saints in Christian history. We've got lots of Christian martyrs, right? Eusebius writes a whole book on the martyrs of Caesarea. At the Hippodrome, about right here, about...
I mean during the Roman period.
During the Roman period, Diocletian, Maximus, others. We've got lots of, and we have numerous names, like at least a dozen or more related to Caesarea. And just around the turn, in the Byzantine time period, early Byzantine, 4th century, we have a chapel that's dedicated, it seems, to these martyrs, which is very touching, very special, I think, to then remember the Christians that died there.
Didn't he live in Caesarea?
Yeah, no, we've got Origen, Pamphilius, and Eusebius. These are the big three. It should be Origen, yeah, Pamphilius, and Eusebius.
And that was during, they lived during the Byzantine
second,
period?
Second, 200 through 350.
Okay, so mostly Roman period then.
Yeah, Roman. So they were suffering, and Eusebius wrote about, he was at that crucial change, right? So he has the vantage point of seeing the Roman Empire turn Christian, and then he writes about these martyrs of Caesarea. What's fascinating is that we also have numerous accounts of martyrs of Caesarea from the Jewish sources as well. And Daniel Boyarin and others have written about Rabbi Akiva, who died there, and many other Jewish sages that were also martyred or killed there, or in Sarot, or in pain and such, after the Bar Kokhba revolt especially, right?
Is that the same Rabbi Akiva that's buried in Tiberias?
The tomb of Akiva is there, and I don't remember if there's much authenticity to it. I can't remember right now. I have visited it recently, but I don't remember. I'm sorry. I know where it is, but yeah.
Brian, a question back at the intersection there of the Cardo Maximus and the Decumanus. If you go on the other side of the Cardo, away from the tax buildings, the city offices, there's a big mosaic with animals and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What was that big mosaic? And then if you come down the Cardo from that mosaic, I don't remember, 50 yards or maybe 100, there's an inscription, again it's on the east side of the Cardo, that says, blessings and peace on the Christians, and may God grant them, you know, a happy long life, etc. Obviously a Byzantine inscription.
Right.
Post-Roman. Do What was along that side of the road?
I don't know.
What was that great big huge mosaic?
I would imagine it's a public building or administration, but I don't know. I know what you're talking about. It's very large. There, we have a tremendous number of beautiful mosaics, not all seen. I visited for the first time 120 medallions. Like that one might have like 40 or 50. There's a estate just up the road, 120 flanked by, it's like a dunam in size, just incredible Byzantine mosaics as well. So
the floor of yeah, someone's house.
Yeah, just really, it's so ironic that Caesarea is one of the wealthy. I mean, it's like it follows that the only golf course, you know, in Israel was there, and all these wealthy people have chosen. So it's just, there's a lot of parallels, it seems, between this very wealthy estates and this very wealthy Byzantine mosaic. I don't know more than that. I would like to move. Let's see, a praetorium. Oh. Next time in a couple years when I do this again, I hope to have a PowerPoint ready with all the sites, with all the pictures in order, rather than just pointing them out here and there. I want to share with you a couple things that are just small again, but that are fun if you're going to visit the site. That in a theater which was excavated by the Italians back in the 60s, I've always known that the Pontius Pilate inscription was found in the theater, but now I know that it's way up on the, what do you call those seats? The cheap sheets? Cheap seats? I mean, actually, it wasn't, because there's a whole cavea, a whole other tier that's completely missing. So you can fit like 3,000-4,000 people now. You could have fit 7,000 people in the Roman period. So it's actually only halfway up. But nosebleeding seats, right? Or something that we call them?
Yeah, nosebleed, yeah.
So about halfway up. Well, today it's at the very end on the left-hand side is where they found that back in the 60s. Now, why is that? Does everybody know what I'm talking about? That inscription of Pontius Pilatus? Right? In the 60s, that was...
No, what did it say?
It says that he dedicated... It's very fragmentary. I'll show you a picture here.
Israel.
I think there's a museum. There's, yeah. What does it say? It says that it's in Latin, and it talks about Prefectus Pilatus setting up a Tiberium, a religious site in honor of Tiberius.
And it's found in the theater?
In secondary use, it's chiseled off and just used for a
chair. Oh.
Yeah, for a bench, for a seat. So it's later, that's been reused in the Byzantine, before the Muslim period or something, right?
Right, right.
And so it just, what it does, it rocked silly scholarship that said, you know, Pontius Pilate doesn't exist, we have no external support, you know. And here we have it in black and white, I mean in stone, right? And we have this inscription. So in the 60s, this is very, very important. Now there's many more things that can tie in, but this is one of the first examples of archaeology showing the existence of a persona mentioned by Luke or by the gospel writer. So
the facsimile, the originals in the Israel Museum here in Jerusalem, but the facsimile is they take it and make a so that you get to feel what it looked like, and that's sitting at the entrance to the palace.
And there's two copies now. One as soon as you go in the entrance by the theater on the right hand side, and one in the heart of the.
And it talks about Pontius Pilate making a what?
A Tiberium. A.
What is that?
Probably, if I can get there, probably a temple of sorts that's dedicated to Tiberius. This.
Second.
Trying to think. Did I bring it? That. There's a. This. This was found in secondary use. A massive statue. Some people think that this statue would have been at the base, sorry, at the back of the theater. I can tell you where most scholars put the Tiberium, because there is the base of a temple which is on the back side of the theater. Can you see the theater here on the map? So if you're looking for it, as you go around through the theater and behind, and there's another oval that was like a place where they sold popcorn and beer or something, right? And right on the edge of that oval that parallels the oval of the theater, there is the base of of a temple. And so it's a suggestion that the Tiberium that Pontius Pilate built is there at the first century level, and this later Roman Byzantine
built on top.
A popcorn area, in a sense, is on top. Mm-hmm. And that the two edges of the platform can be readily seen, and it parallels beautifully the things found in Sebastos, like Samaria, and in Omrit up in the Galilee, and what would have been also right here at the temple. Basically, you have like a dozen stairs and sort of four pillars here, and a very simple sort of temple. This isn't drawn very well, Sharon. but you get the point. The stairs, and these bases are to be found in a few stairs. And they model a very typical kind of Roman temple that's found in Rome, and it seems that Herod copied a lot of things from Rome in his building complex here. By putting the Praetorium next to the Hippodrome and the theater all kind of together, this seems to be similar to Rome. So there's a lot of connections. Okay. So we have this nice connection with Pontius Pilate. We have Paul probably being in area E and maybe F. Ironically, in G, there on the handout, we have what they call a mikveh, which is a little bit befuddling to me, because you've got the sea right there. And I've often taught that in Acts chapter 10, when you get all these Gentiles who have the Holy Spirit falling on them, and then what does Peter say? Peter says, get ye baptized, right? Get ye dipped. Be immersed. And so that's the sea, because the sea is God's water, a mikveh. So we have this interesting private mikveh. Some of the archaeologists, though, have pointed out that it models what we have.
For example, they're not going to build a mikveh?
Right. We have very few mikvot all around the Sea of Galilee. I've heard Yonatan Adler give a couple presentations on this. Also, like in Lydda, up in Macedonia and such, we have a synagogue there and no mikveh. Often the case that you would just go to a stream. For example, I don't know if you know, but a lot of religious Jews are trying to renovate springs around and make them accessible and make them kosher for dipping, right? And you see one down in Moza. You can find them in the Shomron a lot in different places. So, So by water, bodies of water, natural bodies of water, you typically don't find mikvot so much. But, oh, sorry, one moment. But we do have examples that of where Herod wanted to build his own mikveh in a private bath, right?
I can imagine a rich person wanting a nice, warm, clean one anyway.
Right, right. And
especially during winter.
So, and this is paralleled in Masada, right? If you go down the triple palace in Masada, down on the bottom right, you've got this private mikveh and bath complex. So it seems that Herod, even though he was catering to Rome, he was building temples to Augustus, right, Octavian, he was still doing some Jewish architectural designs in his own buildings as well. So that's, I think...
Well, he's a model of syncretism, Herod.
Yeah. Sorry, yes. Yeah.
It's my understanding that the pool, B, the huge pool, was a freshwater pool, so... And even though it's right next to the ocean,
right,
the pool itself supposedly was fresh water. And so if that was fresh water, that would be surprised. It's just a smaller B.
You're right. And they do have they talk about a spring complex in this area of G and such. And we do have a well that's found with 40 different Byzantine curse texts on it. That was found in this well, which is
L
now, from a later period, and so we do have aquifers that are accessible to Caesarea, and this is one argument for people making for that Herod didn't even build those aqueducts originally, that it was only during the Netzavim, the the Roman procurators that they're building these massive aqueducts coming up from the foothills of Mount Carmel. So there's a question of whether Herod was involved with that, because it seems that there's a lot of wells that were dug in the first century BC or AD, and so it's not sure when those aqueducts were first in use. They're probably by the end of the first century, they are. Whether they're in the first century BC is a question. This is another comment that's pretty fascinating, that Herod built his harbor, which is called Sebastos. The city's name is Caesarea, the harbor of Sebastos. Same meaning, but Sebastos is related to Augustus, right? It's the Greek version of Augustus, as far as I understand.
The venerated. Sebastos means venerated.
Okay. And when he built his harbor of Sebastos, he built it so that they cut out places. Like, if you're looking at the harbor, back here, on the southern side, where the waves aren't hitting as much, water could trickle in and flush out the harbor so it doesn't silt up. It's really fascinating. So you don't have to dredge like you have to do in modern days. I don't know why they don't do that as well. But in any case, the architecture is pretty amazing, that he had the ability to bring water in without silting it up, right? And then it would flush out the harbor. Okay, we're needing to move in two more directions I would like before we finish. One is the Jewish, and the other is the chapel. We've already done the chapel. So we're going to finish on the Jewish thing, and this will tie us back into Purim and Amalek. And this is Shabbat, for those who weren't here in the beginning. This Shabbat is special for Sharon, because it's the section that Amalek is always read, and because of Purim coming up. And Caesarea was a hotbed of religious division, somewhat maybe between the Jews, but also between Jews and Syrians. We at the same time that Paul is incarcerated, we have a discussion going on about citizenship rights and who gets citizenship and who doesn't, and equal rights and all these different things. And maybe this is, one scholar has suggested this might be one of the reasons why Paul is sitting around for 2.5 years, because these issues are related to him. He's a Jew, but he's a citizen. You know, who knows? It's interesting. But Josephus talks about how there are hot issues related to citizenship. And one, Josephus gives this example of a synagogue having been built from an earlier time period, and they're wanting to expand. They've got enough money. He says they're wealthier, and they've got enough money to pay off anybody around, but nobody will sell them the land to expand the synagogue. And then not only do they not sell them land, but the Syrians or such build so that they can't get in the entrance of their synagogue, right? Or something like this. They have trouble getting it. So maybe there's a passageway or something like they can squeeze in or something. So this erupts, and some youth who are hotheads, Josephus calls them, get upset. They come to synagogue one day, and they have a sacrifice. There's a man sacrificing a pigeon on top of a pot, which is how the Roman, Greco-Roman religions or Roman religions dealt with lepers, for purifying lepers. And there are many slurs against the Jews for being leprous. And so this is sort of a criticism that you guys are useless and you're lepers and we're not letting you expand. This causes a riot, and I think Josephus gives the number of 30,000, but I can't remember. A huge number of people die. And it goes up to Jerusalem, and they... Oh no, the people in... Anyway, there's... I can't remember if it's...
What time?
Caesarea. This was 65, 66.
The same time Paul did, at the end of Paul's
just
life.
Just after. It's during... Yeah. So there's a riot that goes up to Jerusalem, comes back. Anyway, this is the spark of the first Jewish revolt. And it takes place in Caesarea, related to the synagogue. And I don't know why, but there's one synagogue that's been excavated. And Aviona, what?
The one up north.
Yeah. And I have pictures of it. I'll try to at least get these pictures for us before. I don't know why they haven't done a better. I mean, if I was a tourism national parks, I would do a few things. I would make this church that has all these inscriptions. I would deck it out. You've got these crosses. You've got saints. You've got all this. This could be St. Paul's Chapel, right? Boom. You could do the auditorium, which they've already done. But you could also do the synagogue. And they have found, it's not easy to find, but they found four column heads, Corinthian column heads, with menorahs on it. You've got another marble plaque with a menorah on it. It's like unquestionably a synagogue. So there's, but it was dug. It was first found, you know, back in the 20s, 1920s, and then it was in the 30s a few pieces, and then Sukenik finally in the 40s, who was the father of Yigal Yadin. He published this junky report in 1949, and nothing's been properly published. They get down to Herodian and Hellenistic levels, and they make suggestions this might be, but there's no, this might be a basis for first century synagogue, but there's no conclusive evidence. But if it was, it would add to our corpus of seven first century synagogues. By the way, 100 years ago, all scholarship was ripping on Luke that synagogues were an invention. There wasn't synagogues until after this temple destroyed, right? Now we have seven synagogues.
120 years ago,
yeah. It's still probably, maybe.
He wrote a long article about no synagogues in the land.
Yeah, it's just...
That was an idiotic article.
Yeah, okay. it would add to our corpus. There's a synagogue. Sorry,
it's a first century synagogue.
It's a first century synagogue, and it.
Not just first century.
Here it is. I didn't say first. I'm not thinking. When you respond, it is not necessarily a first century synagogue. We have Hellenistic and Herodian remains of what seems to be a public building, and only in the 3rd century do we have, you could say 2nd maybe, 3rd and beginning of 4th, because it's destroyed in Constantinus II's reign. So you get 330s or 340 something, and there's like 470 bronze.
Late Roman period in that 4th century.
Sorry?
This is late Roman.
So, I mean, all that you can see is something like... I should make this bigger, sorry. But you can see it there. There's the synagogue there. It's not much to be seen. Let me make it bigger, too. So there's not much to see today, but there's a mosaic floor and some remains of the walls right along the coast. And if you get there, there's a sign that says Ancient Synagogue of Caesarea. Anyway, we don't have any other remains of synagogues in Caesarea, and so it's a nice touchstone with the history of the outbreak of the Jewish revolt, and reminds us of Amalek. I don't know if Rome was Amalek there. The Jews were not always righteous, right? But we have Rome bringing trouble upon the Jewish folks at this time period, so I thought it was an appropriate place to end or bring up in relation to Purim and Amalek that we're reading today.
So you say that Rome is Amalek.
There are Jews that have said that.
Midrash says it.
What? Who says it?
The Midrash.
Yeah, the Midrash. Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, times, because the first Jewish revolt, there's a revolt in Trajan, 170, 119, and then the revolt of Bar Kokhba, which is really the biggest revolt of them all. With that, may you be encouraged that there are scriptural connections with archaeology and have firmer faith in the scriptures to live them out on a daily basis. Amen.
Someone went to Caesarea, are the guys there?